Ecocide means unlawful or wanton acts committed with knowledge that there's a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest is Jojo Mehta, co-founder and executive director of Stop Ecocide International. In this discussion, Jojo explains the concept of ecocide. She shares about the background and current state of the movement and how it seeks to provide a legal foundation in the highest courts of international law. I learned a lot in this conversation and hope you find value out of it as well. What a privilege to sit across from Jojo at the end of New York Climate Week. Let's dive right in with Jojo Mehta. Today we are here with Jojo Mehta. She is the co-founder and executive director of Stop Ecocide International. Thank you, Jojo, for being with us.
Great to be with you.
We're just wrapping up Climate Week. It's pissing rain. It's Saturday morning. This is a very last minute. Thank you so much for saying yes. How was your Climate Week?
It's been busy. I've tried to keep things to not more than two events a day. Haven't completely succeeded. Mm. And yeah, of course, you know, then there's always the time zone thing. So juggling sleep is always fun.
Yeah. And any key highlights or reflections from the week?
Well, interesting. I mean, we did one event that we put on ourselves specifically alongside Princess Esmeralda of Belgium. And we had Steve Donziger, we had Atossa Soltani, and we had a couple of amazing indigenous voices, Domingo Pérez and Vanda Witoto. Mm. And that was a focus on demarcation of indigenous territories and ecocide law. And we had this in a fabulous, very unusual venue. And it was just extraordinary. I mean, it was a really sort of epic event and so kind of engaging, real kind of interaction with the audience. And yeah, it was lovely. I mean, I came out of that thinking, wow, we have got to pick unusual venues and have indigenous speakers in everything we do.
Nice.
But it was great. But there's been a number of also kind of high level events. I mean, I was at one the other day where every panel seemed to be kind of ministers and prime ministers. And it was quite extraordinary company. So it's been, it's been a huge variety and really important to get the conversation on ecocide law into all of those contexts.
Yeah, and it really seems to be picking up, and you've been part of this ecocide journey from the jump. Tell us, starting from the beginning, like, what is ecocide? Where is this concept coming from? And let's start with a bit of an explainer.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the term is actually about 50 years old. It was originally coined to describe the awful damage created in Vietnam by Agent Orange, the defoliant. It was first mentioned on the diplomatic stage in the first environmental conference International One in Stockholm in 1972. And it's kind of been, you could say, kind of on the back burner in the sort of legal and political world for decades. There have been various sort of attempts to define it or to sort of move it forward over time. But this more recent sort of acceleration and sort of resurrection, if you like, of momentum around the concept is really owed to barrister and legal pioneer Polly Higgins, with whom I worked very closely for the last 4.5 years of her life. And I say that because sadly she's no longer with us. She passed away from cancer in 2019. She and I co-founded what is now Stop Ecocide International in 2017. Now, that was a response to Polly's discovery that when the governing document of the International Criminal Court, so that's the Rome Statute, the one that sets out war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, when that document was in preparation and was a draft code in the 1990s, there was originally a clause intended to be in it to cover severe, widespread, and long-term harm to nature. And it didn't make it into the final treaty.
Wow.
And I sometimes think it's worth just thinking about what world might we be in now if that had been designated an international crime 20 years ago. And so what Polly felt she was doing with her advocacy, and which is obviously now becoming really a significant global movement, was replacing a crime that should have been there. So we have one key aim, which is to criminalize mass harm to nature, severe and widespread or long-term destruction of nature. Mm. And to do that at the international level. But what's been interesting over recent years is to see how that has kind of caught a light, if you like, in at the domestic level, at national level, also at regional level. So there really is a kind of mutually reinforcing direction, sort of legal direction of travel that is now starting to happen.
And so how is it different than the existing environmental laws that currently exist to try to stop the destruction of nature?
This is an absolutely fundamental question because, of course, there are plenty of environmental regulations in place around the world. And I say regulation because most of them are in the administrative regulatory sphere. There are some crimes, not so many, but there are some. But what's really sort of disturbing and distressing around that is that with all of that body of law, which is relatively young, the last few decades, it's not taken seriously enough. You know, those laws are often badly followed, poorly monitored, you know, woefully enforced. I mean, to give you an example, some of the international environmental crimes that do exist, like wildlife trafficking, illegal logging, these kinds of things, they're already the third most criminally lucrative activity in the world, alongside things like drug trafficking. But the effort that is put into reporting, investigating, and prosecuting those environmental crimes is minuscule in comparison. Mm. And I think what this speaks to is a profound cultural issue. We have a deeply ingrained taboo around, you know, harming people, but we don't have that same taboo around harming nature. And so what we believe strongly that putting in place ecocide as a serious crime, really taking it into the most serious crimes sort of area, and kind of naming those worst harms as crimes, is actually creates a kind of foundational piece that can support and enhance and reinforce all of that existing law and have it taken seriously. Because when you put ecocide alongside genocide, on one level, you're just adding a crime to a list of crimes, right? Mm. I mean, it's quite simple, it's quite straightforward, it's doable, achievable within the system. But on another level, it's really quite a profound thing that you're saying, because what you're saying is that severe destruction of ecosystems is just as bad, just as wrong, just as dangerous as severe destruction of people. And of course, ultimately comes to the same thing. Mm. And that's really important. And there's a big gap there. And that's what's so fundamental about recognition of ecocide as a serious crime.
Yeah, and it's so fascinating to think that it came into terminology through the Vietnam War with the use of Agent Orange. My pre-existing conception of Agent Orange was the damage it did to people. What was the damage that it really did to ecosystems, and why did it get linked in that way?
Well, I mean, it had these horrific effects on foliage, on plant life, on trees. I mean, it literally kind of killed the entire kind of vegetable world.
And that's how it was sprayed.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it was just horrific. And actually, one of the biologists who had helped to develop it originally was the guy who coined the term, because he was absolutely horrified when he saw what it was creating, what it was being used for. I think there is this sense that there is a growing sense, of course, around the world of the kind of ongoing destruction of nature. And this is also kind of combining with the rising frustration at the slow pace of action on climate and biodiversity laws. And we also know from many things, but, you know, more recently from these intergovernmental reports, like the IPCC reports, the BEST reports, you know, that these things are intimately linked. And actually, if we focus only on emissions, we are still going to have a climate crisis. Right. Because, you know, you can stop all emissions tomorrow, but if you carry on destroying carbon sinks and you carry on polluting, you know, the climate regulating ecosystems like the ocean, like the forests, you know, we are still going to have a climate crisis, and we are still going to have, you know, huge nature loss, and it's going to have the most extraordinary knock-on effects. So those things need to be, you know, those sums need to be done. That needs to be put together. Mm. And I think the thing that is so powerful around ecocide law is it speaks to root causes. I mean, ultimately, you know, climate crisis is a symptom, you know, and actually repeated and severe destruction of the environment, whether that's, you know, air pollution, whether that's pollution of the oceans, whether that's, you know, monoculture, agriculture, you know, on a huge industrial scale, you know, some of these things that that you know that have such a destructive effect. You know, we need to kind of do those sums and put in place that outer boundary guardrail, and that's where ecocide law comes in.
Got it. Sometimes the environmental movement gets pushback in terms of, oh, it's just so much fear-mongering. It's just all the things we can't do. It's too depressing to mobilize positive action. You know, now more regulations. You know, what is the positive framing here? How do we focus more on restoring health and you know, the positive visions of the future? And ecocide, it just sounds scary. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, now I can be punished for something. And yeah, what would you say to that line of thinking?
It's interesting because actually what we often find when we, you know, we talk to people about ecocide is weirdly, it's completely the opposite in the sense that, you know, you almost sort of see this kind of light come on in people's eyes and they kind of go, oh my God, there's something achievable that's actually doable that can create some kind of protection. Because I think what we're speaking to here is a bit of a misconception around particularly criminal law. Mm. Because when we talk about crime, people tend to, you know, go off down a dark alley with a knife because that's what crime you know, says right. to people.
Right.
And of course, you know, there's a whole punishment aspect and, oh, am I going to get punished? All of this sort of side of stuff. Now, of course, you know, punishment is a function of how criminal law works. I mean, you know, that's how it works. It's not what it's for. And people forget this. You know, murder isn't a crime to punish murderers. That's how it functions. But what it's for is to stop people killing each other.
You know,
it really is quite simple.
Right.
You can go back to the Ten Commandments, if you like. Thou shalt not kill. You know, it's like that. And so ultimately, criminal law is protective law. It's actually what keeps us safe. And the whole scary thing about this situation is how dangerous it is. We need to put things in place to actually provide safety. And right. that is what criminal law does. And once you kind of, you know, realize that that's what we're talking about, you know, it has a slightly, you know, it has a kind of different effect. And I think the other thing that's important is that when we talk about this to politicians and lawyers, they almost immediately go to, you know, how will this work in practice? Who will be prosecuted? What will be the sentencing? You know, all of these kind of practical legal issues, which are absolutely important, of course. Mm. And, you know, I have no doubt that when the first ecocide case is taken, it will suddenly come home to people. There's no question about that. But the real power of this is actually not when the law comes into place. It's between now and then. Because actually what you're doing by putting this law and particularly this definition, and we can come to this on the table, and showing that there is political progress and legislative progress in this direction, which is very clearly happening, then what you're doing is you're saying, okay, here's your time period. We don't know exactly how long it is. Might be 3 years, might be 5 years. We anticipate it being before 2030, actually. So not too distant, but there is this gap. And that is when you pick up this definition and you go, okay, here's the framing. What needs to happen between now and then that we're actually in line with this and we don't get prosecuted? You know, in our ideal world, we're not about prosecuting people. Mm. We're about protecting the planet. Isn't that the whole point? You know, that's actually what it's about. And I think that it's probably worth having a little bit of a, perhaps talking a little bit about the actual definition.
Yeah, please. I was going to ask you, so how is it defined?
So one of the key milestones in this journey has been the emergence of an international definition. So there have been definitions, well, working definitions of what ecocide might mean in the past. On the whole, they were from individual lawyers or a small group of lawyers, you know, who had their ideas about, you know, I think ecocide should be a crime. I think it should look like this. I mean, Polly Higgins had one and we used her definition as a campaign definition for years. But in order to have the level of credibility that a government is going to consider this and put it forward at the international level or indeed at the domestic level, there has to be something quite weighty, you know, something quite credible. And we had this remarkable opportunity that arose in 2020 where actually, it was Swedish parliamentarians that approached us and said, you know, it's obviously your level of expertise. You know, we had a charitable foundation set up by then as well. You know, could your foundation convene a panel, an international panel of experts that could come up with a consensus definition that we could, you know, politically, credibly take to our government and say, could you propose this at the International Criminal Court? Now, that was amazing because it gave us the opportunity to approach some really top lawyers around the world. Most famously, Philippe Sands KC, who's an extraordinary lawyer who works, you know, who advocates for countries and international courts and so on, but also happens to be an expert and an author on the subject of the origin of international crimes. Mm-hmm. And he was really excited about being involved in this. And he co-chaired the panel that we convened along with an amazing Senegalese jurist, Diour Falso, who'd worked with international criminal law and was the first female prosecutor in Senegal. I mean, you know, we brought together an extraordinary group of 12 lawyers from around the world. And not only was there the sort of geographical breadth and, you know, sort of gender and ethnic diversity, if you like, but also professional diversity in the sense that we had international criminal lawyers, humanitarian lawyers, public international lawyers and climate lawyers. And we also had a range of ideological standpoints, you could say. So we had a former ICC judge. We also had an international law commission member. So more at the conventional end, you might say, well established. Well, part of the establishment, if you like. And at the other end, we had Pablo Fajardo, famously, who advocated for indigenous and local communities in the famous Chevron case. So, you know, we had this whole range of kind of, you know, the more sort of conventional to the more people's lawyers, if you like. And what that meant was that in that drafting process, and it was a 6-month drafting process, and it was backed up by a public consultation with hundreds of responses, with a, you know, specific indigenous consultation as well. Over the course of that time, all of those lawyers had to concede something. Mm-hmm. You know, there had to be a sort of generosity intellectually mm-hmm. in that process.
Sure.
And what emerged from that in June of 2021 was a definition, the core of which was super concise and super clear. And we love it because, you know, it fits on the back of a business card. And that is an extraordinarily useful thing right. when you're dealing with busy politicians who don't have the time to read through a 20-page report. But it's also hugely understandable to the layperson. I mean, it's based on previous legal, you know, on legal precedent. And that's really important from the perspective of, you know, lawyers and legislators. But it's also very simple. If, with your permission, please, I'll read it out. So ecocide means unlawful or wanton acts committed with knowledge that there's a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. Now, you know, that's super simple. It's really easy to understand. And what it does is it creates a kind of intuitive understanding as well as a totally. Legal one for those that have that background. Mm. And that's super important.
So I'm thinking about, you know, large-scale mining projects, large-scale deforestation, you know, deep-sea bed mining, different things that could cause long-term terrible consequences for ecosystems, but also things that run our current industrial system. And so how much does ecocide currently get into trying to adjudicate and understand the activities that are going to fall into these definitions? Where do the lines kind of start and end in terms of where this definition resides?
I think this is a really important question. And I think that it brings a couple of things specifically into focus. One is that this is not a definition that is based on particular activities. And this was a really interesting conversation, as you can imagine, in the legal panel when they were drafting, because, you know, there was quite a bit of to and fro around this. Because most environmental law does focus around specific things that you're not allowed to do, or specific things that you could only do to a certain point, you know, right. a certain level of a certain toxin in a certain context, those right. kinds of things. So, you know, those who are engaged in activities that are potentially damaging are used to dealing with that kind of regulation, almost like how much of this can we get away with in this context before it crosses the line.
Right.
Now, this actually takes a different approach, which was, you know, ultimately where the drafting panel landed, which was a much more consequence-based approach. In other words, whatever you do, wherever and whenever it occurs, it should not create more than a certain level of damage. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's very important because, firstly, you're not demonizing any one particular sector or one particular actor in a given sector. And that's very important. Obviously, it's important politically because, you know, you're not instantly sort of putting people's backs up. Secondly, it's important in terms of the behavior of corporations, because obviously if a particular activity isn't listed, there's an implicit permission, you know, because it doesn't fall into that category.
Right. And
then there's the ways of sort of approaching that to sort of get around it, if you like. Whereas when you have a more of a sort of catch-all type phrasing, if you like, what it does is put everybody on their toes in terms of concentrating the mind and, oh, you know, let's talk to our experts. Let's talk to our operational people. What is happening on the ground? Is it going to potentially fall into this category? And it also speaks to some very, very intuitive understandings. I mean, actually, the beautiful thing on one level about this campaign is on one level, it really is the easiest campaign in the world, because who is going to say that that shouldn't be a crime?
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, we've already got to the point that, you know, we predicted this a few years ago, but I think we're there. You know, no government is going to want to be seen actively objecting to this because they're just going to look terrible. You know, and in the same way, you know, the worst polluters are keeping very, very quiet because they've spent, you know, 20, 30 years greenwashing to the tune of hundreds of millions of pounds of dollars. You know, they're not going to suddenly ruin all that by saying, oh, no, we don't think that should be a crime. You know, so on one level, it makes it very straightforward. But on another, there is another aspect which is really, really helpful. And that is, and I sort of touched on it there, and that is the kind of framing aspect. Because I think one of the things that we are seeing globally is, you know, firstly, this huge frustration at how slow action is. Secondly, a real kind of almost a paralysis, a kind of a panic. How do we actually confront a crisis that is happening on this scale?
Mm-hmm.
And so actually handing people, policymakers, those in industry, a framework that says, you know, almost here's a lens you can look through. Mm. You know, here's a filter that you can apply to all the decisions that you're making that will actually start steering those decisions in a healthier direction. And that's conspicuously missing right now. And that's something that, you know, this definition can do. And when the definition emerged in June 2021, I mean, a very personal way of saying this is that up until that point, I was able to read all the emails in my inbox. It's just gone bananas since then. And I think what it's also done is it's landed well in the political area, and I think in arena. And I think one aspect of that is that there are two thresholds in this definition. So one is the level of, you know, the severity of harm. And that's really important. And but the other is this a second threshold, which is the acts have to be unlawful or wanton. And that means that they either have to be already in breach of some law that's in place,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether that's, you know, some rights framework, some international law, national law covering, mm-hmm. covering that area, or they have to be sort of willful, if you like. In other words, you know, the activity may be permitted, but the result is really disproportionate and you should have known that. So it's mm-hmm. a level of recklessness, mm-hmm. if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows us to kind of bring together the environmental law approach, which tends to be about balancing off, you know, what you're trying to achieve and the damage it's going to cause, with criminal law, which has much more sort of rigorous sort of boundaries, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But what it also does, and I think this unlawful aspect is super important. And actually, I remember when the lawyers were discussing this, I remember thinking, and some of the lawyers had this response, what do you mean it has to be unlawful? Surely we just want to criminalize everything that does this level of harm. And there is, you know, a level at which that's the case. And I think the wanton aspect covers that to some extent. But actually, what's really important with this is that it doesn't tread on the toes of existing law. It
right.
doesn't cut across existing law. It supports it.
Right.
It basically says, you know, because actually, if all environmental regulation and multilateral environmental agreements, like the Paris Agreement, like the Kunming-Montreal framework, you know, if all of those were actually followed, we'd probably be in, you know, we'd be in a good place,
mm.
you know, but often they're not. They're not binding or they're not followed. And so having this kind of foundational piece that says, if what you're doing is in breach of, you know, these environmental frameworks, and you're threatening this level of harm, you know, tap on the shoulder, you could be in criminal law territory. And you can imagine how different a board of directors will mm-hmm. feel about approaching their environmental obligations that exist already. So that's really important. It's a really foundational supportive piece. And the other piece, and this was the piece that really inspired me, I had a kind of eureka moment actually while I was listening to this, mm. these discussions. I suddenly thought, gosh, you know, all of these experts, activists, academics that are doing crucial work on improving regulation in particular areas will all be drawn forward by this. They'll be supported by this, because effectively what it's saying is, you know, whatever you improve will improve this definition.
Right.
And over time, it will be future-proof. It will be dynamic. It will continue to improve and to, you know, to kind of solidify that that foundational support, that safety rail. And it is, again, it comes down to safety. Right. Somebody came up to me at a conference and said, how would you summarize, you know, one word of what you think needs to be put in place in this whole context? And I'm like, safety.
Mm. Remarkable. So it's really a bedrock foundational legal principle that gives all of these other laws better teeth. And it doesn't negate all the existing bodies of work of environmental law, nor does it go against all of the future environmental laws and frameworks and policies that we absolutely need. And I'm thinking about things like the Rights of Nature movement. We've spoken with a few folks here at New York Climate Week working on that space. Can you talk about what you're seeing in that space and where the intersections lie?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And people often ask us about rights of nature because it feels to me like it's very very much a complementary movement. To me also, it's sort of sequential, although I realize that there are developments going on in both all the time.
Mm-hmm.
With rights of nature, we're, you know, looking at, you know, bringing the whole ecosystems, bringing the living world into the legal sphere and acknowledging that it, you know, that it has intrinsic rights, that it may have, you know, certain landscape features, may have personhood, et cetera. And that's actually a really profound shift of the whole legal system, actually. I mean, to mm-hmm. me, that's a far more system-wide shift, mm-hmm. in a sense, than what ecocide law is doing. We see ecocide law as something almost acupunctural. It's so specific and it's so, you can say, I mean, in English, we have this phrase, a one trick pony. I feel like our campaign, our movement, you know, it's a one trick pony. It's asking for one specific thing, you know, do not damage the ecosystems beyond this level. That's it. Mm. But what that does is it's able to be inserted into the existing system without a whole new framework being in place,
right.
Which gives it that potential to be moved quite quickly. And, you know, that's not to say that, you know, there are, of course, plenty of cases around rights of nature that are being taken in concrete ways in many different, I think at least 35 different jurisdictions, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
What ecocide law will do, it's like on one level, you're just, you know, adding one crime to a list of crimes. But what you're actually doing, and I mentioned this earlier, you know, is subtly shifting that sort of cultural mindset so that the living world is taken more seriously and our relationship with the living world is taken more seriously. And that, you know, to me feels like a bridge towards that wider shift that ultimately the whole legal system may well be including nature in a very different way. But I think the other aspect is, again, the protective aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to put this very simply, you know, the basic human right is the right to life. But if murder wasn't a crime, that right to life might not be worth so much. You know, effectively what protects that right to life is the fact that it's a crime to take it away.
Right.
So the criminal side is the kind of protective aspect that, you know, that speaks in a complementary way to the rights of nature. And I think that's where ecocide law comes in that picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautifully explained. So I feel fairly still uneducated about the international courts and criminal law. And I want to go back to like, so can you help me understand what the clear objective is for the insertion of ecocide into international law? And for those of us who aren't as close to the legal frameworks, you know, the significance of how this then percolates and penetrates into every different jurisdiction.
Absolutely. So we aim specifically, ultimately, for the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The governing document is the Rome Statute, and it sets out the international crimes which are considered the most serious concern to the international community as a whole. And that's what's set out in the preamble. Crimes that threaten the peace, security, and well-being of the world. So there really is, you know, it's where the worst crimes are dealt with, if you like. Mm. And at the moment, that statute covers four crimes. Genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and more recently added the crime of aggression. And we believe that ecocide should be a fifth crime in that list. It's interesting because some people's response is, you know, how can you put that alongside genocide? And of course, in terms of the intent, it's very different. You know, people don't, with genocide, you have to actually intend to destroy a people in whole or in part. With ecocide, it's not like that because people don't actually set out to destroy the environment on the whole. They set out to, I don't know, farm beef or, fish or extract minerals or whatever, you know, whatever those activities are that then involve mm-hmm. the the destruction of nature. So the intent isn't the same, but when you look at the consequences and you look at the potential consequences for humanity as a whole,
totally,
it becomes totally unquestionable that totally it belongs at that level.
Yeah.
Now, what's been interesting is actually to see that the advocacy in that direction has sparked conversation at domestic level. There are at least six countries where domestic ecocide laws are being put forward.
Right.
And I mean, one of those, Belgium, is actually almost at the point of being sort of complete in terms of its legislation, which is extraordinary.
Mm.
And then five more in the last 6 months. The EU as well, at the regional level, is discussing right now actually whether to include ecocide level crimes in the Environmental Crimes Directive of the EU. So, you know, this has become a really multi-level conversation and it's mutually reinforcing. But the reason we aim specifically for the International Criminal Court is... It has a kind of, there's a kind of coherence that brings, because when you make something a crime at the international level, mm-hmm, any country that ratifies it is including it in a similar form, or is likely to include it in a similar form in its own domestic legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So you create a kind of coherence there where everybody understands, you know, what it is, you know, the areas that need to be looked at. And what's been really interesting in the last couple of years, as that, you know, that movement has accelerated and national governments have also been talking about it, is that they are taking inspiration from that international definition. So there is a coherence building up in practice, which is very encouraging. Now, in order to actually amend that statute, it only takes one state to propose an amendment. But of course, you know, one needs a certain momentum to actually move that forward, because you need at least two thirds of the member states to be in agreement for it to be adopted into the statute. And then, of course, that states need to ratify. As with any international treaty, you know, a state has to ratify it in order for it to apply.
How many member states are there?
There are 123 currently, which is sort of knocking on two thirds of countries in the world. So it's not everybody, but it is a significant number of states. And also, I think, again, hugely significant is the understanding around it. We understand the worst crimes to sit with that court.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's it's very important, I think, that we, you know, that we aim from an advocacy perspective at that highest level, because that's the shift in consciousness, if you like, that,
right,
that we're aiming for. And I think also what people often don't realize is that there's a potential breadth of application. I mean, the International Criminal Court is a complementary court. It's a court of last resort. It's meant to be where you go when your own national jurisdiction won't address something. And of course, there's an interesting difference here between, say, war crimes and ecocide. I mean, as a war criminal, the likelihood of your own state prosecuting you is non-existent, really. And so, you know, and the same with genocide. You know, so the likelihood is that ultimately you will end up at the ICC, but that's a very slow process.
Mm-hmm.
And the ICC has not taken many prosecutions, and it has been accused of being a neo-colonial institution and prosecuting African warlords. And, you know, none of that is inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
But with ecocide, we feel that there's a rebalancing potential for the court itself here as well. Bring it very much into global relevance in a new way.
Yep.
That is utterly relevant to the global challenges that we face as an international community.
Mm-hmm.
But also it will restore it, we believe, to its intended purpose as a complementary court, because ecocide on the whole will be a corporate crime. So we'll be looking at individuals and, you know, potentially policymakers too, but often it could be individuals within the corporate structures. And those cases can be taken in any ratifying jurisdiction. They don't have to end up at the actual ICC. So there's actually a breadth of potential there.
Mm.
You know, and even if a perpetrator comes from a country that hasn't ratified, if the activity in question is happening in a ratifying country, or if, you know, let's say the specific corporate officer may come from a ratifying country, or there may be an operational office in a ratifying country, there's a number of ways that it could potentially be applied.
Yeah, because, I mean, part of climate change, ecological crisis, destruction of nature that's happening on our planet is a consciousness shift that we are all in this together, right?
Yeah.
And it transcends nation state boundaries, absolutely. And so it makes sense that our ways of dealing with this are also going to take those same approaches. And what I hear you saying is that, you know, this mutually reinforcing, complementary aspect of creating coherence between jurisdictions and international law is really important. And it just makes perfect sense that this would rest in the International Criminal Court, where you have 123 country member states And I'm thinking about too, like a lot of the major ecological and habitat risks that we face looking forward are things like what's happening in the Arctic, what's happening in the high seas, you know, places where jurisdictions are shared, mm-hmm. where there's a lot of ambiguity about yeah. existing frameworks and laws. And so this yet again gives us a really important tool yeah. at the highest court and to make it very clear that the wanton, willful, unlawful acts of destruction to ecosystems is not allowed. We're not going to stand for that. And we should all be in favor and support of that type of rule.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it also speaks to the fact that our economic system is totally interconnected. You know, it doesn't exist in jurisdictional pockets.
Right.
Economic activity involves supply chains that cross the world, involves, you know, transactions that cross the world and that are transboundary. And so, you know, it makes sense to approach this at the international level. I also think it's interesting to see we're beginning to see some interesting responses also within the financial world.
Well, I'm glad you took us there. That was my next line of questions. What are you seeing there?
Well, for example, the International Corporate Governance Network that you may be familiar with, that, you know, its membership is all the biggest asset managers in the world. I mean, they, you know, they manage over 70 trillion in global assets and all the big banks are members. This network puts forward a statement every year to the COP talks. The climate talks. And for 2 years in a row now, they have been specifically recommending governments to criminalize ecocide. And I think that's fascinating. Yeah. And we got in touch with that network and we said, you know, how comes your committee has ended up putting this forward on behalf of effectively the investment world? Mm-hmm. And what they said to us was two things. You know, one was that it's about stability and risk management.
Totally.
You know, effectively what these investors are looking for is, you know, what is going to be safe? Again, it's about yeah. safety. What is going to be safe to invest in the future? You know, and actually having these outer boundaries in place will reduce that volatility. And it will, it will show where there is more certainty, where there is more stability. But the second thing was really encouraging to me. And it was that, you know, part of that conversation was simply, it's really serious what we're facing mm-hmm. and something muscular needs to be in place to deal with it.
Yep.
And that I think is fundamental. And to have that kind of realization, you know, at the, you know, those kind of potentially those highest levels of finance where often other laws don't reach, you know, where there are kind of, almost kind of get out clauses, if you like. I mean, a bank,
yep.
you know, when it lends money, as long as it does its due diligence at that first level, you know, the company that we're lending to is clean, it doesn't have to go into that whole kind of supply chain background. But at the same time, you know, that institution cannot finance genocide. Right. It cannot finance murder.
Right.
And so effectively putting a criminal law provision in there actually reaches some of the parts that other places don't reach. And I think this is also mm-hmm. really important. I'm going to go right to the other end now, to the kind of grassroots level, if you like, because the corporate PMR machine has done an absolutely fantastic job of making individuals feel personally responsible for climate change.
Totally.
And that is utterly unfair. It's untrue. It's false. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't all have responsibility. Of course we do. Mm. You know, and our, you know, it matters what we do. It matters what we buy. But let's face it, the vast majority of the world can't even afford to make those choices.
Mm-hmm.
It's a distraction from the decisions that are happening at the highest level, or I should point out, are not happening at the highest level. So that business as usual essentially continues. Finance continues to flow in the usual directions. Now, if I'm Mrs. Jones from down the road and I'm going into a supermarket and everything's covered in plastic, I did not choose that.
Mm.
And I suddenly have to be wealthy to make a decision about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not fair.
Mm-hmm.
And effectively, what ecocide law does is it goes right up that chain to the beginning of the production chain, mm-hmm. to those decision makers at the highest level, because that is where those decisions are happening. That is where those subsidies are happening. You know, and, you know, personally, for example, I mean, I live in a rural area, means I drive a car. I can't afford anything other than an old banger because I just don't have any care. I can't go buy a Tesla. And in any case, there are other problems there that we can talk about in terms of sourcing transition minerals. Again, mm-hmm. super important. You have the rules in place to make it safe because otherwise we're just going to jump from the fossil fuel frying pan into the, you know, cobalt and lithium fire, you know. And so there have to be those rules in place. But the point is, I can't afford to even make those choices. And that is not something that comes, you know, at the level of consumers or end users. And we're not just consumers, we're citizens. We actually want to have some decent options given to us by our government.
Right. Yeah. And I think about it's so easy to demonize the big corporations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've certainly spilled my fair share of words in that regard. And, you know, these are groups of individuals and people who are increasingly awakening to the ecological yes. crisis and want to do something. And we need these types of regulatory and legal frameworks, because in the absence of them, what you're asking are people to make voluntary changes
yes.
when they're in highly competitive environments. Uh-huh. And so it's like, well, we don't want to do this extra thing that's going to destroy the forest, or we'd love to curb back this activity and put more cost on our supply chain to do this more sustainably, but we can no longer compete.
Yes.
Or we can no longer fulfill the demands of our shareholders. And yeah. so you have a lot of cogs in the machine, so yeah. to speak, not referring to the people as cogs, but in terms of all of the incentives and all of the different machinations inside a large scale, multinational, corporate, et cetera. And I think that one of the challenges of the environmental situation that we're in mm-hmm. is that there is this kind of, well, we're only fighting with this moralistic duty and responsibility. Mm-hmm. And what we have to do is make sure that we're changing the rules and the incentives of the game.
I think that's absolutely fundamentally important, because what it does is level the playing field.
Exactly.
Because, you know, I mean, it's all very well in a way, as I just did, to talk about how it's not fair to the person on the street, but it's also not fair
right.
to those who want to do the right thing in the corporate world. You know, and actually, you know, many are actually asking for stricter guidelines
totally.
Precisely for that reason, because, you know, ultimately, obviously, those who are way out front in the sustainability, you know, leadership game, mm-hmm. they're not the ones that need this rule.
Right.
You know, it's everybody else because they're having to struggle with their bottom lines. They're having to struggle with their shareholders. They're having to struggle with keeping, you know, their businesses afloat and all of that. I mean, obviously, you know, with the big corporations, you know, a small, you know, what may be, you know, may to you or me seem like a simple shift, just stop doing the really damaging stuff. In the terms of the knock-on effects of what that, you know, what they then have to put in place in terms of their supply chains, in terms of their due diligence, can be massive. And it's really important that it applies to everybody, actually. And that those, and I think what it also does here is it brings again into focus the importance of the operational level, you know, which is actually somewhere in the middle, if you like, in terms of, it's not necessarily the C-suite executives who may be the ones who have to watch their backs in terms of, you know, this law. But actually what it does is it should really empower those who are in the operational sphere, who really are the experts in their sectors, because they're the ones, you know, that should be picking up this definition and going, okay, you know, I know what we're doing in this area and I know what needs to be done. And actually what that does is it gives the risk management people, the legal counsels, it gives them a different focus. So the due diligence stops going down the road of how do we get away with XYZ and starts being more like, oh gosh, well, what do we have to adjust to make sure we don't fall foul of this thing? You know, it's a very different approach. But it also, as I say, it means that, you know, the finance can't keep flowing to those that want to do the least. You know, it has to actually, everybody has to take account of the same thing. And that I think is really important. I think the other thing that it's important to mention is it's really tempting to point at, you know, ex-CEO and say, you know, you're the bastards that are doing all this. We have to remember that the system we live in has developed over centuries.
Right.
This is a mindset problem. It is not ultimately down to Bond villains. I mean, there may be one or two, I don't know, you know, sitting there stroking their white cats, but mostly those people are the logical, you know, what they're doing is the logical result of decades and even centuries of an attitude where we see ourselves as separate to nature. We see ourselves as lords and masters. We see ourselves as using, you know, the planet as an infinite bank of resources. And, you know, it isn't infinite. We know, you know, we've known this ever since those photos from space. You know, we're in this little blue ball. And, you know, ultimately we all need to survive. And so it is about, I mean, and actually we see this definition, we see this law as a gift, actually. It really is a gift to those that are making decisions, because it enables them to actually start steering, you know, the civilizational ship, you know, back from the precipice.
So where are we at? What's the current state of affairs? It seems like the conversation, as I receive it, has picked up momentum. You mentioned six countries at least talking about ecocide in their respective jurisdictions. Mm. Paint us a picture for where we're at in the movement.
So we're at what we feel is kind of, a sort of snowballing type moment, in the sense that, I mean, five of those six jurisdictions, those proposals went into parliament in the last 3 months. You know, it's really Wow. started to pick up. And that was so Brazil, Spain, in Catalonia, Mexico, Italy and the Netherlands. And Belgium, as I say, is already quite advanced. The EU is having conversations. The Council of Europe, not to be confused with the EU, the Council of Europe is the body that put in place the European Court of Human Rights, has also, made resolutions and recommendations around ecocide law and is working on a convention that will likely include it. The Interparliamentary Union, which is the oldest sort of intergovernmental interparliamentary organization, very old organization, 179 states also has resolved to support it. So, there's, and also, I mean, the World Council of Churches, the Alliance of Mother Nature's Guardians, which is indigenous leaders. Mm. So all of this, and the youth movement, I mean, all of these things are coming together now. You know, there's a really huge momentum, which is fantastic. So we see a clear direction of travel, and we see a lot of conversations happening in the wake of this really very precise thing. I mean, mm-hmm. I sometimes like to see it as if you draw a pencil through water, for example, the pencil itself is very narrow, it's very precise, so it doesn't create a lot of resistance. But behind, the wake is huge. The eddies and ripples that are being created are huge. And what we're seeing is some really strong voices, particularly from the victims. And this may be unsurprising, but, the Pacific Island state, or perhaps we should say Great Ocean state of Vanuatu, is absolutely at the forefront of this. And they've already achieved incredible things diplomatically, moving forward, a request for an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice around climate change. And ecocide law is another of the legal tools that they're championing. And of course, those Pacific Islands are absolutely at the sharp edge of climate change in terms of sea level rise and so on. And then we see also Ukraine, which is horrifically suffering victim of environmental damage through armed conflict. And they are very strongly pushing for ecocide law to be, to be engaged with. And they were very supportive at the Council of Europe, for example. And it's interesting that they're one of the few countries that have some provision for ecocide in their own penal code, but they're really looking at the standalone crime as a step forward, because they don't, they're actually being, in a way, politically generous and sort of saying, we don't want to see anyone suffer what we're suffering. The amount of land that is mined in Ukraine now is just insane. I mean, the level of environmental damage, and some of it will be irreversible. It's extraordinary. And then we also see indigenous voices being raised around this, particularly from the Amazon, where the concept of ecocide is very live. And so that, again, we're seeing, really key, vital ecosystems, which are not just about, carbon sinks and emissions. They're about the regulation of the water system and all of these aspects that go with the key rainforest areas of the world. And finally, we're also seeing support coming from advocates that are working with the oceans. Mm-hmm. Because, we are a blue planet. There is, 97% of the surface of the planet is water. And we're looking at the biggest climate regulator there is in the ocean. And so pollution of the ocean has this very, very direct effect. So we're also seeing very strong support coming from there. Mm. And that's, all of those strands are kind of coming together and effectively saying, this is about this particular system, but it is also about the entire planet as a whole. And that's, I think, really important to bear that in mind. This really is a planetary issue.
So how does the movement fund itself? And you're an advocacy organization, a nonprofit. How also do you fund yourselves?
Well, this is a welcome question, I should say, because, we're always, looking for support from a funding perspective. But the way that we fund ourselves currently is we have, it's a mixture of individual donations from the public and foundation grant funding. And we have two key areas. So we have a restricted fund that, when people actually join the campaign as members, if you like, and we call our members Earth Protectors, they join, they put money into an Earth Protectors fund that is specific specifically restricted to use moving the diplomatic work forward, and it, particularly in support of climate vulnerable states. Now, admittedly, that remit is getting wider as time goes on, but effectively, so for example, you know, our presence at the COP talks, you know, it can be funded from that. You know, our presence at New York Climate Week, we're having diplomatic meetings, all of that kind of thing can be funded from that restricted fund. But we can't do salaries and operations from that. So we have a separate fund for that. And, you know, both those funds are sort of doubly funded from individual donations and from foundation grants. And it sort of varies a bit over time. We've probably got slightly more foundation grant funding than we had before. But of course, you know, as the visibility gets bigger, we also have more public donations. So we're not funded by governments in any way. And you know, we do occasionally get corporate support from sustainability type corporations. But that's quite a small percentage. Mm-hmm. But what we have always operated with, and anyone who's started an NGO from a grassroots activist level, which is where we started, you know, we'll be familiar with the kind of, you know, we're always sort of 4 or 5 months from the wall because, you know, we're constantly kind of, you know, working on getting to the next, you know, sort of bootstrapping ourselves, you know, from one stage to the next. So, you know, that is a very, you know, that is a very real thing for us. And we have not yet, you know, got stability funding. And actually, it's kind of crazy because when you think about, I mean, we've actually reached... I mean, like as you were saying, we're an advocacy NGO. We are ultimately about driving a conversation. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is hugely valued, interestingly, in the business sphere. You know, everybody understands that the lobbyists that work for big companies, you know, have incredible impact.
Totally.
But interestingly, you know, in the sort of philanthropic world, that's not very well understood,
right. Actually.
You know, the advocacy, the importance of advocacy is not well understood. And yet, it's incredibly good value for money. I mean, we've managed to get the conversation obviously it's not only us, but we've been kind of at the heart of the sort of driving of that conversation. But, you know, we've gone from zero governments talking about this to a global level diplomatic conversation in 5 years in just over $5 million.
Wow.
That's nothing. It really is nothing. So, you know, we're constantly in this position of going, just look at what we've done, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, here's a horse you can back. I mean, I think it's such an exciting opportunity. And obviously, you know, we'd love to talk to people who are interested in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the return on value to think about a foundational legal framework that will define at the highest courts in our world for now and for future generations. On such a paltry relative sum of funding compared to how much money is in the economy and going to all sorts of things. It seems to me like it's the kind of thing that future generations are just going to look back on and be like, well, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Does it feel that way to you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that obviously kind of keeps us going is that, you know, there is such a kind of, in a sense, an obviousness to it. Mm. And sometimes people do say to me, you know, how do you go on in the face of, you know, what's going on? And I just feel like, you know, I mean, I guess it speaks to those, you know, those threads like stubborn optimism, like, you know, the necessity of hope and all of those things. But, you know, I don't think you can manifest something in the world unless you believe it's possible to do so. Mm. And unless you believe it's, actually, in my case, it's inevitable. You know, it will actually happen. You know, in a sense, all we're doing is kind of channeling something that, you know, absolutely must happen sooner or later.
Yeah.
So in a sense, we see ourselves as accelerating an inevitable movement. We don't want it to get to the stage where we, you know, we are literally hanging on by our fingernails going, oh my God, we should have put this law in place. Mm-hmm. You know, we want people to kind of go, oh yeah, right. That's a kind of obvious one. That's a no-brainer. Let's do that.
Right, right. Any final messages or remarks? And I'm thinking also about Polly Higgins and her legacy. And yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, I found out about Ecocide. I remember Charles Eisenstein sent something out when Polly was speaking about this many years ago. Mm-hmm. And to watch it go from such a fringe idea to where we are today. And yeah, just really honoring her and acknowledging her. But in your words, curious, any other reflections?
I think there are a number of things that have kind of contributed to that kind of real expansion of the movement and of the initiative. And one of them was actually Polly dying, which is just, you know, which is a tragic thing to say, but I think this is, it can happen that way. And we've seen it in other circumstances. I really feel like she was actually a martyr to the cause because, you know, of course she didn't intend to go out early and she didn't intend to go out that way. But I remember in the last week of her life, actually, and at the time she was really only seeing two or three people at that time, her husband, myself, one or two close associates. But I remember it happened at the same time, and this was another real contributing factor, at the same time as Extinction Rebellion launched in London in 2019, the first sort of major rebellion, if you like. And of course, also kind of coordinated on a global level, if you like, with the youth strikes that Greta Thunberg inspired. And I think we mustn't underestimate the contribution of those grassroots disruptions, because, you know, every movement in history, whether that's the suffragette movement, the civil rights movement, they've all seen those grassroots disruptions opening up that conversation. And that happened at, it literally happened. It was coincidental. I mean, it happened at the same time as Polly was dying. And I remember her saying in that last week, you know, seeing, I mean, she wasn't strong enough to be out and about, but seeing it on her computer screen and seeing the demonstrations in London, you know, the placards saying stop ecocide, you know, for the first time, what she had been saying for a decade was actually hitting the streets. And it was hugely emotional. And, you know, and she said, oh, Georgia, you know, she said, it's all going to happen now, you know, and had this beautiful, soft kind of Scottish accent she had. And she was right. You know, it was almost like she kind of pressed this massive on switch, because, you know, we went from people in our community saying, oh my God, you know, what will happen when she dies? Will the work die with her? To this extraordinary coming together of people after she died, you know, approaching me and sort of saying, you know, what can we do to make sure this work doesn't die with her? And realizing that there were campaigns, there were grassroots groups, there were politicians, there were lawyers, there were people all over the world, academics, you know, who had often been inspired by her work and you know, sometimes elsewhere too, but you know, sort of saying, what could we do to help move this forward? So it really feels like the last few years have been a gigantic dot joining exercise, actually, of kind of linking all of those people together. And what we've found is that we've ended up working on this dual level. So between the diplomatic level with, you know, the politicians and the diplomats and often closed door meetings and all of that sort of thing, but also this incredibly widening civil society conversation, where what we feel we've been doing is cross-feeding as much as we possibly can to have this conversation, you know, expand into as many sectors as possible, mm-hmm. so that, you know, there's this kind of, you know, we all kind of know that politicians don't like to be the first to a party. You know, they want mm-hmm. to go there when there's already a conversation, mm-hmm. and they feel safe talking about it. Again and again comes back to that word safety. Mm. So yeah, I feel like, you know, what this is a real kind of global bringing together of people that want to have a safe future.
Georgia Mehta, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been great to be with you.
Okay, I hope you got something from that discussion. To learn more, go to stopecocide.earth, where you can also make a contribution. For more Rights of Nature content, check out the interviews we did with Natalia Green from Global Alliance for Rights of Nature, as well as Grant Wilson from Earth Law Center. I'd also highlight that point that Jojo made at the end about the importance of disruptive climate protests. For more on that, you might be interested in the discussion we had with Margaret Klein Solomon from the Climate Emergency Fund. All of those links are available below in the show notes, as well as our website, maearth.com. Especially if you're in the philanthropic or funding space, take note of just how few resources this part of the movement currently receives. Let's join together and make sure we're funding this important work. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on the next one.